So I want to talk about quite a practical thing today, learning to live. It's the first in a two-part series on mentoring in the Bible and how that applies to us. So I find myself thinking, well, what is a normal life? How do you learn what's normal? If you think about what it just means, I'm not even talking about a Christian life necessarily, but just living your life, doing the shopping, paying the heating bills, all that kind of stuff. What's a normal way to be? And your idea of what's normal, you're going to pick up from what's around you, from the people that you know, from your family, from your friends, also from the culture more generally. And that can be quite a bad thing. So, for example, if you watch EastEnders, that's not written to be realistic or any of these things. They're written to be entertaining, and conflict is entertaining. So in all of these shows, what you see is every relationship is always in conflict. Nobody's ever just... you never get a husband and wife just happy together, do you? There's always something going on. And so if you're not careful in watching these things that are just intended to be interesting and entertaining and tense, you will learn the lesson that this is what all relationships are like. And then that's a step towards your own relationships being that way. So this is the kind of thing that we need to think clearly about. We need to be intentional about how we understand the nature of life. So a much healthier way to learn these things is from people that you respect and admire. So instead of learning how people relate to each other from soap operas or, heaven help us, Jerry Springer or one of those things, much better to look around you and see people that you know who you think, well, they seem to be living their life well. They get on well with people. They're on top of things financially. They're getting on well with their family members. Their job seems to be going okay. Just look at how those people are doing and say, what can I learn from them? So that's better, to copy the way that people who live well live their lives. But what's even better than that is if somebody who you like and admire will take you under their wing and help you to understand what they're doing and understand why things are working the way they are. And then that's mentoring. And that's the theme, really, of this week and next week. The idea that you can not just learn by watching somebody else, but by being alongside them and by having them draw you along in their wake. Now, there are loads of examples in our lives, and often they won't just be to do with the whole broad business of how we live our whole lives, but about something specific. And you learn, again, the best way to learn anything is from people, isn't it? So when I started to become serious about studying dinosaurs, the best thing, by far the best thing that happened to me in that area was fell in with, really became good friends with a scientist in America, Matt Wadle, who's now one of my best friends, and I learned a lot from him about, not just about dinosaurs themselves, but about how you go about the process of study and how the whole academic system works and things like how you put together the material that's going to become a study and all the sort of details and nuts and bolts. I learned most of that not by reading stuff about how it's done or hearing lectures, but by being alongside someone who was doing it. Or another really valuable example, I think, is from learning musical instruments. And I know a lot about this because Fiona is, among many other things, is a flute teacher. And when she's teaching somebody a flute, there are many different facets to how that works. One thing is just she shows them how it's done. She's a model of how you want to be if you're playing the flute. And then what she'll do is have the person she's teaching have a go at playing the flute. And then she'll sometimes even physically correct them, stand behind someone and move their arm around and change exactly the position of the flute and say, this is how you want it to be. Very detailed, very specific. And then critique their performance and then feedback and then show what they're doing wrong. So it's a very involved thing. It's quite a close sort of a relationship that's involved there. And that's part of the reason why it's so effective. And then one that I've particularly enjoyed is when I preach, sometimes, not always, sometimes I get some feedback from Tim that can contain some encouraging elements. and of course, the big one, there's maybe the most important form of mentoring that you can't help but be involved with if you are a parent, is parenting. People say all the while, don't they, that your children will learn more from what you do than from what you say. And that's absolutely right. As you grow up, the way you run your lives, the way you run your relationships, your kids are watching and they learn from that. And especially with very young children, more as much as they can at a young age, they model themselves on you. And I kind of miss when our boys thought we were really great at everything and that we knew everything. But of course, the goal of that is to get them to the point where they can move beyond that. So it's a lot of mentoring relationships, rightly, don't run permanently. They don't run forever. They run for a while to get somebody up to a point. And then we hope that we can send the boys out into the world and they'll not just be like little replicas of us, not quite as good as the original, but that they'll surpass us. And that they'll do better and greater things than us and live their lives better than we have. So these are some of the goals. And what they have in common is all of them are about wanting to grow. So I wanted to grow as a paleontologist in learning from Matt Wadle. All Fiona's flute pupils want to grow as musicians. I also want to grow as a preacher. You know, as unwelcome as it might be when Tim will say, well, you did these 8 things wrong. But that one thing was really good. That's how you grow, isn't it? By seeing what's not right and putting those things right. So you need that. And of course, parenting. Your children, the whole point is that your children grow. They grow up. They don't remain children. They become adults. That's what you want. So for the person being mentored, it requires some humility to just stand there and have Fiona adjust your posture and say you're doing this wrong. Or for children, especially as they reach a later age and it becomes less obvious to them their parents are right about everything. Oh. You know, I just suddenly think about a Mark Twain quote. He says, when I was 16 years old, I was amazed at how ignorant my father was. But then 10 years later, I was astonished at how much he seemed to have learned. Well, so, and the other general point I want to make before I get into the specifics about mentoring is that it does involve personal contact. So, and what I'm drawing a distinction here between something like however much I admire Tim Keller and however much I learn from reading his books or listening to his sermons or anything else, that might be valuable to me, but it's not the same thing as mentoring. So mentoring involves a personal contact. It would be, if Tim Keller were to come over here and criticize my preaching, that would be... Okay, so with that, those general remarks out the way, and I hope we all share an understanding now of what I mean by mentoring, I want to look in a little bit of detail at one example of mentoring from the Bible, and that is, as Rosie gave away earlier, at the relationship between Jesus and Peter. Now, I do want to just note 2 things about this that are a bit unusual and that mean not everything in this will directly apply to us, although I believe all the principles will. And there are 2 things here. One is that in this particular mentoring relationship, Jesus was modeling the whole of how to live life for Peter. And that's what Peter was learning, everything about how to live. Now, most mentoring relationships that we're involved in will be much more focused on one specific element of what we do. So learning to play the flute, learning to preach, whatever it might be. So here are some really practical ones. Learning how to handle your finances. So it can be really helpful to come up alongside people who seem to have that under control, understand how they do their budgeting, that kind of thing. So, but in this case, Jesus obviously is acting as a mentor for the whole of Peter's life. So that's unusual, though it does happen. And the other really important thing to bear in mind is that Jesus, as God and as the perfect man, was a perfect mentor. And none of our mentors are perfect. And if we expect them to be, the only thing we're going to achieve is disappointing ourselves. And putting an intolerable burden on them. So we do need to recognize, again, the examples here, Jesus does this right. When we're looking to mentors, we'll find they sometimes don't get things right. And it needs some strength of character on our part to look past that and still see the things they have to give us. And of course, when we have the privilege of acting as mentors for other people, we are also not going to do it perfectly. And when that happens, what it calls for in that case is just for us to recognize that and apologize to the person concerned. So those are a couple of ways in which what I'm going to show you now from Peter's life are not quite the same as it is for us. But let's see how these principles look now. So here's the first thing. If you're filling in the handouts, there are five headings that I want to talk about with a fairly long Bible passage from each. So I don't just want to jump from verse to verse here, but we're going to look at whole stories and see what they tell us. So this is the first one. These are all from the New Living Translation. Jesus knew that the Father had given him authority over everything, and that he had come from God and would return to God. So he got up from the table, took off his robe and wrapped a towel around his waist, and poured water into a basin. And then he began to wash the disciples' feet, drying them with the towel he had around him. When Jesus came to Simon Peter, Peter said to him, "Lord, are you going to wash my feet?" Jesus replied, "You don't understand now what I am doing, but someday you will." "No," Peter protested, "you'll never ever wash my feet." But Jesus replied, "Unless I wash you, you won't belong to me." So Simon Peter exclaimed, "Then wash my hands and head as well, Lord, not just my feet." Now, maybe the principal thing that's going on in that passage is this. Jesus is not just telling Peter the way to behave. He's not just saying, you need to be a servant to the people that you lead. He's showing him what that looks like. He's modeling it. He's demonstrating it. It's important for at least two reasons. First, it's very difficult to do something that you haven't seen someone else do. But secondly, it's difficult for you to really trust someone who tells you to do something he's not doing himself. So if Tim comes to me and says, "Mike, it's very important that you," I don't know, I should have thought this example through before I started. Yeah. So suppose he says, you really should be serving tea and coffee every now and then, because just do one of these really straightforward, helpful things that just help people get on with their lives. But if Tim was never doing that himself, then I would look at him and think, well, hang on a minute, if it's that important, why aren't you doing it? Well, but in fact, he would be. And that's what's going on here. So Jesus is not just saying to Peter, serve people, wash their feet. He's doing it. He's showing them what it looks like. So another thing to recognize here is that Peter's response to this is kind of funny, actually. So he starts out by saying, well, I'm not going to let you do this to me. For a very good reason. I think it's pretty clear what Peter's thinking is, Jesus, you are greater than I am, and it's wrong that you who are great should serve me. Now, that shows a good kind of humility and a good understanding. So and that is good as far as it goes. But it has to be superseded by a deeper understanding of a deeper truth, which is that the greater person can serve the lesser person. Not often, the greater person should serve the lesser person. So that's a thing, a really generalizable thing that Jesus was showing Peter here. That it's not just wash people's feet. It's not that specific physical act that's important here with a bowl of water and people's feet. The important thing is this, that however great you are, you can serve other people. And that's often the right thing to do. So what he was teaching Peter here was not just a specific lesson, but a very general one about how to relate to groups of people, especially in Peter's case. Remember, Jesus will have known then that Peter was going to be the leader of the church. Now, how tempting would it be as the leader of the church, the only church in the world, to be all superior and to float around and have people doing things for you? But no, right early on here, Jesus is making sure that that's never how Peter gets. That Peter understands from the outset that if you're leading, you do that by serving. And I also like that as soon as Peter understands what's going on, he's 100% on board, isn't he? He's been saying, "Oh, I'm not going to let you wash my feet." The moment he realizes what's going on, he says, "Oh, okay, wash my hands and head as well." It's pretty sweet. It's that enthusiasm, I think, about Peter, which crops up again and again. That probably is part of the reason why Jesus chose him to lead the church. Now, Peter makes a ton of mistakes, again, as we'll see. But that's kind of redeemed by the passion that he has that drives him even sometimes in the wrong direction, but ultimately always towards Jesus. So here's the second example. And this one is about this. The first thing is that mentoring consists of is modeling things, demonstrating, showing how to do it. The second thing that a good mentor will do is invite questions and discuss and encourage and sort of chew things over and move them around and help people reach a conclusion. So here's this passage I'm going to read again, also from Matthew's Gospel. When Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say that the Son of Man is?" "Well," they replied, "some say John the Baptist, some say Elijah, others say Jeremiah or one of the prophets." And then he asked them, "But who do you say I am?" And Simon Peter answered, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God." Jesus replied, "You are blessed, Simon, son of John, because my Father in heaven has revealed this to you. You did not learn this from any human being. And now I say to you that you are Peter, which means rock, and upon this rock I will build my church, and all the powers of hell will not conquer it. And I'll give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you forbid on earth will be forbidden in heaven, and whatever you permit on earth will be permitted in heaven." Now, at the beginning of this passage, the first thing to notice is that Jesus could very easily have just told his disciples who he was, and then would have had a gospel where it says, "And then Jesus gathered his disciples and told them, 'I am the Christ, the Son of the living God.'" But that's not the way he goes about this. Instead, he does it by asking questions. Now, this is a very common thing among good teachers. I was really aware of it when I was learning maths. I had a maths teacher who almost always, when somebody would ask him a question, would fire one straight back at him, and essentially just to direct the way that person was thinking about the mathematical problem. Sometimes they get all carried away, he'd say, "All right, I'll be Socrates, you be Plato," and then he'd ask all these mathematical questions. But it's a common technique to teach by asking questions. And the value of it, of course, is that you're not just telling people facts, but you're pushing them into thinking. So that what you think about, not only will you understand it more clearly, it'll settle more firmly into your mind. And maybe partly as well, Jesus is maybe also asking the question because he wants to find out how much the disciples understand already. And actually, they seem a bit confused in places, don't they? When they're saying, "Some people say that you're John the Baptist," well, that doesn't make a lot of sense because Jesus was alive at the same time as John the Baptist. So either the disciples were confused or they were talking to some confused people. Or maybe you're Elijah or one of the prophets. And Peter, at this point at least, seems to be the only one who sees right through that and sees that the essence, the substance, the reality of who Jesus is. And the other thing to spot here, of course, is just that Jesus is so encouraging as well in response to that. Because Peter has seen this, because it's been revealed to him by the Father, really. Jesus gives this quite long speech up on the slide at the moment, beginning, "You are blessed, Simon, son of John." And I'm not going to go into at all the details of what all this stuff means about things being forbidden on earth and forbidden on heaven. It's a whole long, complicated thing of its own. But all I want to draw attention to is that Jesus is so warm in response to what Peter's seen here. So that this role of encouragement is always so important. That a mentor is not only trying to impart information to somebody, but also to lift that person up in encouragement. So that's the second component then of mentoring. The first one was modeling what to do. The second one was inviting questions, discussing and encouraging. The third one is this, offering space to try things. So a mentor will not just be demonstrating, but also saying, "All right, now you try this. You have a go at this." And again, we've got a Bible passage that explains this really nicely, which I'll read to you. "Meanwhile, the disciples were in trouble far away from land." They were in a boat, by the way, weren't just swimming. "For a strong wind had risen and they were fighting heavy waves. About 3 o'clock in the morning, Jesus came towards them walking on the water. When the disciples saw him walking on the water, they were terrified and in their fear they cried out, 'It's a ghost.' But Jesus spoke to them at once. Don't be afraid, he said. Take courage. I am here. And then Peter called to him, Lord, if it's really you, tell me to come to you walking on the water. Yes, come, Jesus said. So Peter went over the side of the boat and walked on the water towards Jesus. But when he saw the strong wind and the waves, he was terrified and began to sink. Save me, Lord, he shouted. And Jesus immediately reached up and grabbed him. You have so little faith, Jesus said. Why did you doubt me? Now, obviously walking on water is a very extreme example of a thing that you would copy a mentor doing. So this is one of these cases where I'm saying, because we're using the example of Jesus and Peter, the precise example really doesn't apply to us. But the principles, I think, very much do. So what's happening here is that Peter sees Jesus doing something that he admires, and Peter's response is that I want to do this as well. Now, in our lives, it would be something more normal. Like, I see someone who's bringing up their children well. And then you would think, okay, I want to be like that. I want to bring my children up well too. So, in this case, it's walking on water. Now, again, you'll notice that Jesus isn't asking Peter to do something that he isn't already doing himself. Just as in the first example, when it was washing people's feet. Jesus didn't just sit in the boat and say, right, Peter, now hop over the side, off you go, see how you got on walking on water. Jesus does it first. Like any good mentor, he begins by showing somebody how you do the thing. So Peter's not just trying to follow instructions, but copying someone. And it's very impressive that he initially, at least, is very successful. Now, he's obviously learned something. Now, in this case, it's not that he's learned a technique, obviously. It's not there's some special technique for walking on water. It's all about his faith in Jesus. And the thing that he's learned here is how very much to trust Jesus Christ. And that, of course, is why Jesus has disappointed him in the end. When Peter's he's begun well and his trust, his faith in Jesus, his belief in the goodness of God has been strong enough to let him walk on the water, and then he just wavers and starts to sink. And that's why Jesus says, well, you have so little faith. Why did you doubt me? Now, the question there, I think it's really important that it doesn't just say, why did you doubt, but why did you doubt me? The issue isn't Peter's faith wasn't strong enough. It's that Jesus always was strong enough and Peter didn't trust him. So that's how he fails there. But, you know, even there, even in this story that you could say, you could summarize this by saying it's the story of how Peter failed to walk on water. But actually, he did walk on water. None of the other disciples did. They were all still in the boat. So there's some credit to be given to Peter here. And again, as with the first one, when he gets all excited about, okay, then wash my head and hands as well. Again, what's going on here is that Peter just has a straightforward devotion and an open-heartedness towards Jesus that makes him want to try these things. Even if it's going to fail, he wants to have a go because he wants to be like Jesus. There's a lot to be said for that, isn't there? So here is now the fourth of these five things is maybe a little less welcoming, and that's to do with feeding things back and correcting. This is not all warm, touchy, fuzzy. Here's another Bible story. From then on, Jesus began to tell his disciples plainly that it was necessary for him to go to Jerusalem and that he would suffer many terrible things at the hands of the elders, the leading priests, and the teachers of religious law. He would be killed, but on the third day he would be raised from the dead. But Peter took him aside and began to reprimand him for saying such things. Heaven forbid, Lord, he said, this will never happen to you. Jesus turned to Peter and said, get away from me, Satan. You are a dangerous trap to me. You are seeing things merely from a human point of view, not from God's. Now, this is a hard rebuke, but it's because of a really fundamental misunderstanding on Peter's part. Now, Peter at this stage is obviously thinking the way Jesus' life is going to develop is just that his ministry is going to get bigger and better and encompass more people and sweep everything before him. He might be thinking that Jesus ultimately is going to kick the Romans out of Israel. Maybe he's not thinking in political terms. Maybe he's only thinking in spiritual terms. But he's seeing Jesus building up a bigger and bigger movement. He's fundamentally misunderstood at this point what Jesus is on the earth for. And that's why Jesus has to correct him so strongly, really. It's not just a matter of adjusting Peter's course there. It's not he's going basically the right way, but just needs a little nudge to go off here. Peter's understanding of what Jesus is doing on the earth is completely wrong, and he needs to be picked up from here and moved over here and plonked down facing the other way. That he's not here to build a successful movement. He's here to suffer and to die, to achieve something far, far greater than any movement could achieve. Now, this would have been pretty painful for Peter. And it can be a painful process. Absolutely it can. And it's just part of what's involved in benefiting from a mentor. You know, if you find yourself a very, very nice mentor who never criticizes anything you do or corrects anything you say, then actually you're not getting the best value out of that relationship, because what you want ultimately is to be right and to be doing things right and thinking right. Now, if Jesus had been kind to Peter and not rebuked him in this situation, then Peter would just have carried on thinking he understood the nature of Jesus' time on earth. And then when Jesus was captured and crucified, imagine the devastation then, if Peter had only then understood. So the unkind thing that Jesus does here, as it might appear to us, turns out to actually be the kind thing. And that's because he's looking further ahead, because he's looking beyond the current moment. He's not just doing what seems nice now. He's actually thinking, what is the kind thing in the long term overall? So there's a thought for those of us who are mentoring someone else. Sometimes it is not, this isn't a license just to be unkind, obviously, but sometimes actually you need to look beyond the here and now and what's going to make this person feel good right now and say, actually, what is going to build them? What is going to help them? What's going to get them to where they actually want to be? So the fifth thing and the final thing is this, that a mentor, and this ties in with what I was saying really about kindness, is not just somebody who is modeling and discussing and teaching, but also loving and forgiving. It's somebody who cares about the person being mentored. And I want to read this. This is the longest passage, but also the last one. It'll take a while, so just settle back and let the words of this sink in. This story is from John's Gospel. This is after Jesus has died. He's been resurrected, and in his risen form, he's already seen the disciples, including Peter. And then it says this. Later, Jesus appeared again to the disciples beside the Sea of Galilee. This is how it happened. Several of the disciples were there. Simon Peter, Thomas, nicknamed the Twin, Nathanael from Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two other disciples. Simon Peter said, I'm going fishing. We'll come too, they all said. So they went out in the boat, but they caught nothing all night. At dawn, Jesus was standing on the beach, but the disciples couldn't see who he was. And he called out, Fellows, have you caught any fish? No, they replied. And then he said, Throw out your net on the right-hand side of the boat, and you'll get some. So they did, and they couldn't haul in the net because there were so many fish in it. And then the disciple Jesus loved, that's how John refers to himself, by the way, in writing the gospel. So then John said to Peter, It's the Lord. And when Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his tunic, for it stripped for work, jumped into the water and headed to shore. Well, the others stayed with the boat and pulled the loaded net to the shore, for they were only about 100 yards from shore. And when they got there, they found breakfast waiting for them, fish cooking over a charcoal fire and some bread. I'll bring some of the fish you've just caught, Jesus said. So Simon Peter went aboard and dragged the net to shore. And there were 153 large fish, yet the net hadn't torn. Now come and have some breakfast, Jesus said. Well, none of the disciples dared to ask him, Who are you? They knew it was the Lord. And then Jesus served them the bread and the fish. And this was the third time Jesus had appeared to his disciples since he had been raised from the dead. After breakfast, Jesus asked Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, Do you love me more than these? Yes, Lord, Peter replied, you know I love you. Then feed my lambs, Jesus told him. Jesus repeated the question, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Yes, Lord, Peter said, you know I love you. Then take care of my sheep, Jesus said. A third time he asked him, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Well, Peter was hurt that Jesus asked the question a third time. He said, Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you. And Jesus said, feed my sheep. Now then, ever such a lot going on here. Obviously, there's at least one whole sermon in this passage. So again, I'm going to skim over. But a couple of the things to pick out here. One is, again, Peter's straight-up enthusiasm. Now, John is the first one to notice, to understand that it's Jesus on the side of the lake. And yet, he who calls himself the disciple Jesus loved, he's not the one who jumps overboard. Is it Peter? He's 100 yards from shore, can't wait for the boat to get there. He's just overboard and going. Now, this is happening a matter of days after Peter has denied Jesus three times. Do you remember at the Last Supper, Jesus says, one of you is going to deny me? Peter says, well, it'll never be me. I don't know about these other guys. They might, but I never will. And then actually, Peter is the one who three times denies Jesus. Now imagine yourself in that situation. Then how would you, when Jesus turns up, wouldn't you cringe a bit? Wouldn't you want to hide behind a pillar? Wouldn't you want to let other people be the first to talk to him? Wouldn't you just kind of hope to avoid his notice? Peter's not like that, because whatever else is going on with him, however flawed he is, however weak he is, what he's got going for him is an absolute passion for Jesus. He loves Jesus. So he's over the side and he's gone. And leaving the others in the boat, probably raising their eyebrows, thinking, fine, we'll bring the boat into shore. But Jesus is Peter's there, and he's got there with Jesus straight away. And obviously Jesus appreciates this, because after everybody else has come ashore and has fed everybody, they've got the fish and the bread, they've had the meal, it's clear Jesus takes Peter aside, and he has a little bit of time just for Peter himself. Even among everybody else he wants to speak to, everything else that's going on, he's got some time just for Peter. And then how does that work out? Well, he asks him, it's a surprising thing this, he asks him the same question three times. Do you love me? Well, why does he do that? Well, it's because a few days earlier, three times he's been asked a different question, which is, do you know this man? And three times in those days earlier, Peter gave the answer, no, I don't know him. Three times he denied Jesus. What Jesus is doing here is offering him the opportunity to step by step wind that back, to undo that. And just as three times he basically said, I don't know this man, now he's got three opportunities to say, yes, I love you. Essentially, he's got like a three-stage process to apologize separately for each of those times. That's why it goes around three times. So what's happening here is that it's not just that Jesus forgives Peter, but he's going through a process to make sure that Peter understands that, to make sure Peter knows that. So we would expect, of course, that Jesus from his heart forgives Peter. But I wonder whether you've ever been in a situation where someone says they forgive you and you don't really quite believe it. You think, I appreciate that you're saying that, but I don't believe it really. And Jesus is walking Peter through this three-stage process to say three times, yes, Lord, I love you. Yes, Lord, I love you. Yes, Lord, I love you. To take that back, to undo what was done before. And of course, the response to that is that Jesus commissions Peter, saying three times, feed my sheep, or variations on that. Look after my sheep, feed my sheep, feed my lambs. All three of those phrases is saying basically the same thing, which is be the shepherd of this flock, be the leader of this group. So the very same Peter who got it all wrong in trying to dissuade Jesus from letting himself be crucified. Ultimately, although he misunderstood so completely there, Jesus put his understanding back on track and corrected him and got him into this position where Peter's great enthusiasm and affection and love for Jesus, combined with that, makes him the one of those 11 people there who is best positioned to lead the church, the one that Jesus chooses to lead the church. It's an amazing turnaround. And it comes in part because of Peter's humility and his readiness to be corrected. So there's a lesson there for us when we're benefiting from somebody else being our mentor. So that humility is just such a valuable part of it. So the very last thing I want to just touch on, having covered all these five examples, is then just to say what to look for if in your own life you're looking for somebody to help you out in some way, whether it's generally in living your life or more specifically in some particular process, even something as simple as learning to play guitar, you know, whatever it might be. What do you look for in a mentor? What things make someone a good person to be your mentor there? Well, I think they're both basically the five headings I've given here. So first of all, you want somebody who models the thing that you want to improve in. There's no point trying to learn guitar from someone who can't play guitar. You want to begin by looking for somebody who can do the thing that you want to do. And secondly, you want to be looking for somebody who will discuss it with you rather than just laying down rules and just saying, do this, go off and learn these three chords. Who will talk about, well, why these chords? Why do these ones matter? And when you're playing something with this shape of your fingers, what happens if you move it this way? And so that you're learning, not just by rote, but understanding the thing that you're learning. And you also want somebody who is going to offer you space to try something. So if you have a mentor who just says, follow me around and watch what I do all the time, you'll learn something from that, but nowhere near as much as you will if that person says, well, you've seen me do this three times, now you have a go, we'll see how it goes, and then we'll come back and look at it afterwards. And then the fourth thing is exactly that, the feedback. You want a mentor who will be honest with you about how you're doing and who will be encouraging when you've done something well, but also who won't be frightened to point out your mistakes when you've done something wrong. That's how you're going to improve. And the last thing is just this. You want someone who loves you, someone who cares about you. You want somebody who isn't just going to see you as a mentoring project and you're going to get through a six-week mentoring program and they can tick that off and think, okay, I've mentored one more person, but who actually cares about how you're doing and wants to see you grow as Jesus wanted to see Peter grow. And I could also say that ultimately, of course, we want God himself to be our mentor. Now, all the things we're talking about here, that they can be more difficult when we're dealing with a God who often to us feels far away rather than a human who we can see and feel and touch. And yet ultimately, you know, he is our best model. He is the one who we want to resemble. He's the one we want to learn from. He is the one who ultimately will encourage or rebuke us in the way that counts. And most of all, he is the one that loves us, who most wants our growth, who most wants us to achieve all the potential that's in us, who wants to bring us to the point where we are all that we can be. So I hope that we can respond towards God with that same affection and passion that Peter did towards Jesus. Well, Father, we want to thank you for the examples in your word of one person learning from another and growing and becoming greater for it. And especially for that most extraordinary example of all, of Jesus himself teaching and helping his disciples to grow, not only in knowledge, but also in character, not just in what they can do, but in who they are. And we do pray that you yourself will draw us up towards you and help us to more closely resemble you, but also that you will give us people, humans, who can help us in specific areas and help us to move along and to spot and to understand and address flaws in ourselves and to build on the things that are strong in ourselves so that we're able to be more the people that you intend us to be. And we pray as well that you'll give us opportunities to act as mentors to other people. And in areas where we are strong and where we have experience and where we have success, help us please to see how we can help others in those areas and to share in those same successes that you've given us. Thank you that we are a church, a body of people, a family, an army that functions together, that builds each other up. Thank you that you don't just call individual Christians in isolation to live on their own, but whole groups of people to be together. Thank you for all the verses in the New Testament that tell people how to relate to each other, love one another, respect one another, submit to one another, encourage one another, all of those instructions in the letters. And we pray that you will help us in this church to learn from one another in the best possible way. In Jesus' name, amen.